From the Sky News Centre at 5. The Prime Minister has rejected calls for a panel to sit alongside a judge leading a public inquiry into the Grenfell Tower disaster. Some survivors wanted a more diverse group to work alongside Sir Martin Morbick, but Theresa May said no because it could slow down proceedings. Our senior correspondent Ian Woods explains what they wanted.
They weren't seeking local people to be put on the panel. They weren't saying it had to be somebody from Grenfell because they know that they would have their own biases and their own views. What they were asking for, though, was people who come from the same ethnic background as the majority of the victims because they felt that that would be fairer.
There's huge disruption at Bristol airports where the runway's closed on one of the busiest travel days of the year. A plane from Frankfurt came off the runway this morning. No one was injured. The Foreign Secretary and his Russian counterpart have clashed over the Kremlin's alleged cyber attacks on the West. Boris Johnson insisted at a media conference there is abundant evidence of interference. A murder investigation started in Manchester after the bodies of a man and a woman in their 30s were found in a property this morning. The deaths in the Harper Hay area are currently being treated as unexplained. The Scottish First Minister's criticised the colour of our passports going from burgundy back to blue. It'll happen post-Brexit, as Kieran Corr reports.
Please have your passports ready for boarding.
In 2019, those will include blue British ones. The Immigration Minister thinks it will bring back our national identity.
We are a sovereign nation and we can reflect that in a document that actually means so much to so many people.
But Nicola Sturgeon insists it's blue passport-obsessed nonsense. Prominent Remainer Gina Miller says questions must be answered.
Are we going to have to show our passports in different queues?
The blue passports will also include new features to protect us against fraud.
And in sports, Rangers have appointed Graham Mertie as manager until the end of the season. He's been in caretaker charge since Pedro Caixinha was sacked in October. That's the latest. I'm Charlie Banks.
Hi, this is Paul Davis from the Sports Saturday Show, and I'd just like to wish all sports fans and listeners a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
I love Christmas in Bristol. I get to go shopping with my husband and I get to spend all his money.
Happy Christmas.
One nation, one world, on Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor and leader of the Lib Dems 2, councillor for Knoll, Gary Hopkins. Still failing in our attempts to get Marvin into the studio. The mayor, that is. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, President Trump announces his new national security strategy this week. 1 year from being elected and we find China and Pakistan are no longer in Donald Trump's good books. Plus, Catalonia seems the people have been asked to vote again on whether or not they've had enough of Madrid, and they voted the same way. What a surprise. And propaganda, the origins of the term in the Vatican, says sociology professor David Miller from Bath University. Plus, the founding fathers post-World War II of the mental health profession, including, surprisingly, the governor of the Bank of England, Montague Norman. Plus the third and final part of our look at the rise to power of Israel's far-right leader, Benjamin Netanyahu. After the signing of the Oslo Peace Accords in September 1995 and the assassination of the Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, on the evening of Jerusalem's biggest ever peace rally, a wave of terror attacks followed, and Netanyahu rode to power in the May 1996 election, becoming a permanent fixture on the Middle East scene for the last 20 years. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 10 degrees Celsius, mainly dry. Christmas weekend, temperatures around up to 11 Celsius, mainly cloudy and breezy at times, but hopefully without rain. Next week, highs of 10 Celsius, some sunshine and showers, but breezy at times. Next weekend, that's the 30th and 31st of December and the 1st of January. Highs around 10, sunny spells, but some heavy showers next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from the Weather Outlook. com. So I'm pleased to welcome the leader of the Lib Dems on Bristol City Council, Gary Hopkins. Hi, Gary. Welcome to the Politics Show. First of all, I'd like to just ask you a general sort of look at what's been going on at the City Council, because what we've seen is the settling in of the new Mayor Marvin Rees, and that quite a lot of structural changes going on up at City Hall, we've got to call it now.
Well, yes and no. It seems to be going round in circles and ever-decreasing ones as well. There's big investment in producing nice glossy leaflets and people putting out stories on behalf of the administration. But in terms of actually moving things forward and getting things done, it's just not happening.
Well, hang on a minute, because there's been an enormous shake-up in the structure, management structure, surely.
Well, there was going to be. And we heard what the new structure was going to be a few days after the last chief executive left under quite interesting circumstances. And we had this plan put in front of us which said, you could see it was designed to have everything feeding through the chief executive but with the head chopped off. And then it went out and around all the senior officers and various people discussed it. And it's now come back, the final version, almost back to where we were before she got involved stirring things up.
When you say with the head chopped off, what do you mean by that?
Well, you can have organisations where they're designed to be cooperative and cooperative management style, and you can have organisations that are designed to be one person's and completely in charge and everything goes through them. And basically, the second system doesn't normally work very well, but that's what we're designed. And we've effectively now, we're going to have a sort of an amalgam of the two, which is what we had previously.
So you've had a lot of new managers in, though, surely. What effect does that have up at City Hall? A lot of new senior management. I mean, it's fair to say a lot of people would be quite pleased to see some of the old faces go, won't they? No, but senior management in a local City Hall aren't exactly the most loved people in the city, are they?
No, they certainly aren't, but actually some of them did know what they were doing, and they've been rather amazed to see bright sparks come steaming in through the door with a whole pile of fresh and brilliant ideas, which were ones that failed last year or 2 years before or 3 years before that. And that's what we've actually seen time after time at different levels of the organisation as well. There's no ability to learn from previous mistakes because everything has to be completely new. I mean, that's the buzzword. But unfortunately, if it's not thought through properly, it doesn't work.
Well, one of the local stories this week to do with the council is the Marina Boatyard's future is in doubt because of mystery Bristol City Council plans. That's at least the headline in the Bristol Post. We won't have the space for the many commercial boats in the harbour, such as the Tower Bell, Bristol Ferries, to be maintained, repaired or safety checked. So these are essential facilities for repairing, checking, even building boats. And it seems that the City Council is thinking of changing the use of this whole area. I mean, it's on the southern side of the harbour. And if you're driving past up towards the Portway, up towards Hotwells, if you look across or walking or just sitting there and enjoying your day, you'll see there's quite a lot of boat building and there's a whole marina there. But apparently this is going to be either going over for housing or being used for people to just sort of leave their luxury boats there.
Yes, and very unfortunate would be too if that turns out to be true, which unfortunately I think it probably is. The employment that's there, the interest that it brings, I mean, Bristol is still, although it's only on a smaller scale than it used to be, a working harbour, and that's part of what makes it interesting and part of what people come to see. And I'm afraid, hundreds more housing units being stuck next to the water Will not improve the look and feel of the harbour.
No, but it's actually what land is most valuable for at the moment. At the moment, you'll find that only a tiny amount of revenue is generated from that land in terms of rent for looking after a few boats. Surely it's going to be a lot more money for the council, and I'm assuming the council own this. I mean, that's why they're being asked. Entirely sure, but I think I'm pretty sure they do. They're just looking at various blocks of land like any commercial landowner would and saying, actually, we can make more by doing this with it. I mean, that's in the current circumstances, Gary, what with the cuts, surely that's just prudent to do that.
Well, the short and long term decisions, aren't there? You can make more money in the short term by flogging off a piece of land to a developer, getting lots more units built on there. But if they don't provide employment and they don't provide the sustainable way of life into the future, then that's a short-term win, but a long-term lose. We coined the policy within Bristol some years ago, which is now unfortunately being completely abandoned, which was balanced and sustainable communities. Where basically...
Well, hang on, that's just a buzzword, surely.
No, it's not just a buzzword. It's a matter of thinking how you can reduce the people's need to travel for everything. At the moment, Bristol is practically gridlocked. And it's because you can't... The employment and the other facilities that people want are not close to where they actually live. And if you use urban design properly, you can reduce the need for people to travel.
I mean, that's going to take hundreds of years.
No, it doesn't, actually. You can gradually adjust that over a period of time. But it's a matter of thinking sustainably in terms of planning policy when you're actually, before you actually build new things. How is this going to look in a few years' time? What do we need to have to go with it? I mean, the spatial strategy, which was supposed to be a joint venture with the four local authorities in the area, actually it was four separate plans, stuck together rather inexpertly and a right old mess. And bluntly, they've decided to put in a huge development, housing development, at Whitchurch and around that area, which will just not work because the transport links aren't there and can't be included in there. Whereas in Ashton Vale, we've got the transport links there available, and it would be far more superior, far, far better development. But, the council at the moment is thinking short term. How can we make some quick money, make a quick buck and throw up some units?
The council wants to renegotiate Bristol Marina's lease and shrink the area of the dockside used by the business. A section of land between the slipway and the old disused Abel's Dry Dock next to the SS Great Britain is being sought after, and taking it from the Bristol Marina business would put the entire future of the firm in doubt. The council has its own, as yet, unspecified plans for this area of land, which is used by the marina. Okay, Gary, what's your best bet? If you could be a fly on the wall in the right office, looking at the right piece of paper, sitting on the shoulder of the right person up at City Hall, what's the plan for this bit slice that the council want to take away from Bristol Marina?
Well, a quick buck and a maximum number of housing units so they can claim they've hit a target.
Bristol Marina's owner Davina Lund said her business needs the space to operate its heavy boat lifting equipment. If they had less room, staff could not lift the biggest boats in and out, which would stop one of the most important income streams for their business. The marina was to close. It could mean the only place capable of maintaining, repairing and lifting the harbour's passenger ferries would close. She also said her marina is the only spot capable of providing access to the water for the dredgers needed to clear the harbour, prevent it from flooding the city centre. The loss of boatyard space will mean the boatyard will quickly become unprofitable, she will. Now, Martin Summers, do you think this is just the business bleating here, or is there an attempt really to squeeze traditional businesses out because of economic pressure?
Well, obviously, I don't know the detail or the figures that people are looking at. Obviously, I generally wouldn't be happy to see a business like that removed. And I think the suspicion has always got to be that they're going to turn it into luxury flats, of which there is a surfeit already down there. Is it going to be social housing? supposing that they're going to build? I doubt it in that location.
The other question's got to be, are they actually going to build them? Because you quite often find that companies come in, they get their planning permission, and then they think, well, once we've sold the previous lot of homes we built somewhere else, will we actually build these ones? In fact, if you go to Finsel's Reach now, you'll see there's a whole side of the development there which has deliberately not been completed and just left, so that as they sell the luxury flats they've already built, Martin, they can then start finishing off the other ones they've got planning permission for.
Well, I think this is the basic problem, is that developers have the whip hand, and especially in the circumstances, as you alluded to earlier, with the council being strapped for cash and all the rest of it, the temptation to just let them have their head and then get some money in the short term to so that you can keep services going in other parts of the city that you want to keep going is going to be strong, isn't it? It's going to be very difficult to resist that. I don't know the detail. But, of course, the idea that the whole centre of Bristol should be turned into one great big yuppie paradise with lots of very expensive flats which locals can't afford to rent or to buy... doesn't sound very attractive at all, does it?
Ms. Lund said the plans seem to be shrouded in secrecy and added it isn't even clear where the new plan has originated from or whether Bristol councillors have been involved or informed.
No, we certainly haven't been informed or involved, but that applies to 90% of what's happening in Bristol City Council at the moment.
Would you explain how that, why nothing's changed? Surely it's always been like that.
No, it hasn't, actually. Basically, since the introduction of the mayoral system, where all the power is in one pair of hands...
You're going to blame Marvin again, aren't you?
Well, not Marvin as such, although he's obviously one of the two candidates. Basically, it's the system that encourages this sort of behaviour. Because, I mean, there are large numbers of people within the Labour Party who are supposed to be in charge, and Labour councillors, for that matter, are very unhappy about the way things have been done. But he doesn't have to listen to them. He can just do it his way, pull in, you know, a few consultants or pay them a fair amount of money so they'll say exactly what he wants to hear and carry on in his own sweet way.
Well, Lorna Stevenson in the Bristol Cable, based up in Stokes Croft, which is quite an interesting publication. You can get a share in it if you want, and you can go along to their meetings and encourage them to do stories on the sorts of things that you would like, rather than, I mean, I suppose if you're quite wealthy, you could probably buy shares in the Trinity Mirror Group and feel like you could influence the Bristol Post as well. But this is very much more hands-on and in your face. She said at the end of last month in an article about the mayor's sacking cabinet members from other parties that Marvin doesn't want more headlines. What does she mean by that?
Well, what she means is that he's absolutely outraged by the fact that anybody might actually disagree with him and write something in the media that that he thinks is an affront to him.
Well, I mean, this is surely the reason why, or at least one of the reasons why, he's sacked members from other parties, because he feels that they're going out to the press and simply briefing against him. He's bringing them in, he's attempting anyway to bring them in, and they are then using the information they're gaining within cabinet meetings and running off to the press and bleating about him.
Well, as it happens, in the case of the three councillors from the three different groups, in not one case did he come up with any complaint against any of them, and none of them, to my knowledge, from whichever party, have ever leaked any information at all.
Martin, what do you make of the mayor system? Because things have definitely changed, hasn't it? Gary's detailed there, with a mayor, things are quite different over the last, whatever it is, 8 years or so.
Well, Gary and I obviously agree about the mayoral system. The mayoral system is flawed to the point of being, you know, possibly unsustainable. I mean, Ken Livingstone, when he led the GLC in the 1980s, was the leader of the Labour group on the party and leader of the council. He wasn't a mayor, and he was opposed to mayoral politics.
Well, that's an interesting
point. I believe he's still opposed to the mayoral system.
I think that's an interesting point to make, because the point where Labour won... with Marvin winning the mayoralship, he wasn't leader of the party, Helen Holland was, and suddenly Helen Holland is a backbencher. Actually, now she's in the cabinet, but it does, I mean, this is a competition in a way between whoever is elected as the leader of the group and whoever is elected to stand as mayor.
Well, I mean, what you've got now, as Paul Smith pointed out on this show the other week, is you've got a Labour-led council with a mayor. And that's normal stuff. That's what you'll see in Manchester elsewhere. It's actually quite abnormal to have more than one party running the council when they've got the votes. I mean, the Labour Party are the largest party. But on the other hand, I think you've still got the fundamental problem that the Labour Party can't control the mayor. And therefore they become an independent force, able to do things without consultation and so on. Now, of course, if they're acting wisely, they will consult, certainly with their own party, if not with anybody else's party. But the temptation to overrule everybody is going to be there with the mayoral system, which gives total power in one way, but then actually removes the power of the council to do many of the things that it wants to do. So then you're stuck with gimmicks, where the individual who is the mayor comes up with gimmicks, because the actual getting on with just providing the services that they used to provide, they can't do that, so they've got to think of something else to do, so they come up with, you know, with various whiz-bang schemes. It's a fundamental problem.
The underground springs to mind, Gary. Is this going to happen?
No.
No? What makes you say that?
Well, because, firstly, there's no public finance money for it. So one thing was challenged with that. He said, well, we can get private finance in. Well, really, I mean, like it or loathe it, the Labour Party have a policy of nationalising railways. You know, so why would private sector come along and want to invest money behind a Labour mayor?
Because if it got nationalised, which is by no means certain, then they would get compensated, wouldn't they?
Well, would they? They would be taking a massive risk on a scheme. With a lot of these schemes, people put in lots of money in early stages, and sometimes they don't come to anything at all. It's a big risk. They'd want to know that they're going to get their money back. And let's face it, he won't be around in a few years' time to ensure that they get their money back.
Martin, it sounds a bit of a contradictory policy, the idea of a privately built underground here in Bristol.
Yeah, well, it'll probably fail for the reasons that Gary's just mentioned. I think all big infrastructure projects have got a big question mark over them, because the interest rate that we've currently got isn't going to carry on forever. And at that point, various things... And that's why we've got an investment strike in Britain in general. Businesses do not want to invest because they don't know what the future is. And that's going to go for an underground or any other plan that you've got. I don't know whether it's viable or not. It might be in the long run viable to do something like that. I wouldn't like to guess.
Sent me a terrific email yesterday, thank you very much, Martin, pointing out quite a nice piece in The Guardian about Hinkley Point. It's the long read, which is often excellent in The Guardian, even though The Guardian itself is quite problematic often on foreign policy and things like that. The headline is Hinkley Point, the dreadful deal behind the world's most expensive power plant. Building Britain's first new nuclear reactor since 1995 will cost twice as much as the 2012 Olympics. And by the time it's finished, nuclear power could be a thing of the past. How could the government strike such a bad deal?
Well, as you say, it's a long read, and they go into the detail about why it's such a bad idea.
Well, we'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But, you know, after about, whatever it was, 5 years ago or so, they made a big kind of announcement about this. We just keep hearing time and time again that there's been a hiccup, there's a problem, there's a slight difficulty with the Chinese money for it, and also that the power costs from it are going to be astronomical.
Well, I think that's the fundamental thing. The people who, the private sector, well, it's not the private sector, what it is, it's not nominally the private sector, but it is in fact the public sector of France and China, which have decided to pick this up for their own reasons. And they've had to be promised an electricity price, which is guaranteed, and then that will be put on electricity bills of every consumer in the country. And of course, unlike taxpayer subsidy on electricity bills mean that the poor and the rich pay exactly the same, and so it's a tax on poor people to have nuclear power. And I think what happens with these things is once you've got to this stage of having been doing it for years and started clearing the site and digging the foundations and everything, if you were to stop, you've wasted all the money that you've already spent on it. So then you think, oh, well, we've got to go on. And that's the problem with all sorts of things.
Well, having a chat with some people who are in the know about nuclear power, what they've said is that there's enormous delays to this. And also that it's dependent on the relationship with the European Union, that EDF is extremely much embedded with the French government, and also that the EU has been making some important safety regulations. So one of the things that Brexit will do was it'll say, oh, you can build whatever you want pretty much now. But the problem is that there's another power plant, I think it's Flamanville in France, which is the first ever version of this type of reactor ever built, and it still hasn't actually generated any power. And what they've said is that you've got to have this thing working for at least, I think, is it 6 months or a year successfully before you're allowed to start building Hinkley. Well, of course, they've made a lot of groundworks, but what are they actually doing down there? Or do you know, Gary?
Well, they're spending a lot of money. I mean, the business plan is fatally flawed. And it made all sorts of assumptions were made in the way that electricity prices were going to go, and completely ludicrous negative assumptions regarding the cost of renewable energy generation, which actually has moved rapidly in the right direction.
So, Martin, why is it that governments sign these contracts with the Chinese for things which are actually not going to benefit the public here, it seems, at all? In fact, they're going to be we're going to have to be paying more for our electricity because of Hinkley.
Well, they ended up being stuck with the Chinese and the French because nobody else would pick it up. I mean, they tried to privatise the nuclear industry back in the 80s, and private sector said no way if we have to take on the costs of decommissioning and so on. And fundamentally, the real reason why we're still building new nuclear power plants, because it has implications for our nuclear weapons, and that's in the article as well. One of the consultants says, well, actually, it's all about nuclear weapons. So the poorest electricity consumers in Britain are going to be charged more so that we can carry on having nuclear weapons. Happy Christmas, everybody.
Gary, is it that simple?
Not just as simple as that. I think, basically, that these big schemes get a sort of a momentum of their own, and lots of wrong assumptions were actually made. And at the time, government weren't all that convinced about renewable energy, which, quite frankly, they should have been.
I mean, there's always the revolving doors with people in government sort of ending up in the industries that they're spending government money on. Then there's also, for example, in the arms industry, well known, bungs go to political parties and to individuals for signing these contracts. I looked at the whole HS2 business in that light as well, because you do wonder whether they're now projecting it's going to cost £111 billion, this HS2 project, and yet there isn't enough money to pick up litter in the street here in Bristol.
Well, I think that priorities are wrong. I mean, again, partly connected to the sort of presidential model that Conservatives and some of the Labour Party seem to be wedded to.
Yeah, maybe they've just borrowed this from the US. Well, what is happening with basic stuff like picking up litter? We're being told, aren't we, that actually we're very sorry, but there isn't really going to be that good a rubbish collection service, litter picking service from parks, public spaces, streets, that sort of thing, Gary. How are you, people in your ward up in Knowle, coping with that?
Well, I mean, our park, which is one of the things that people care about, is well looked after. We've got local volunteers. They wouldn't volunteer for the council, but they will volunteer for local services. And I think that's part of the thing that the administration haven't worked out, that they think they can get people to just volunteer for Bristol City Council.
Hang on a minute, because when you were in the City Council, in the Cabinet, you were talking about selling off parts of the parks, weren't you? Selling them off to private developers.
Nope. We were talking about getting rid of some surplus green land, but not parks. And basically, the point of that was to provide investment, because with parks, you can't just leave them to decay. In the decades before that we came into administration, 104 children's playgrounds were closed across Bristol because they were gradually allowed to decline and the investment wasn't put in there. So you do need to put investment in. It's not just a matter of leaving things as they are. And that capital wasn't available, and it's certainly not there now. And people are actually getting desperate to think, how are we going to keep our parks going?
Well, one of the things that's changed with almost without people noticing is the lack of scrutiny up at the City Council too. Yep. Some of the committees have gone. I mean, the whole idea of neighbourhoods, what's happened with the neighbourhoods? Because that was one of the ideas where we'll bring people in from neighbourhoods to help decide how money from their council tax is spent in their area.
And actually, it worked fairly well. It got a bit bureaucratic under the last mayor, But still, a lot of people did actually make an effort for their area. They came along, got involved in decision-making, put voluntary effort in, but I'm afraid that's all been abolished. The mayor doesn't like it.
Surely it's they can't afford it.
Well, no, you could in actual fact do a lot better without spending any more money. He's gone down a path of abolishing this. And one of the things that they're doing, which is verging on being, well, certainly questionable from a legal point of view, is that there's still money that's a rake off from any development that actually takes place. 15% of that is supposed to be spent locally. Instead of that, they're now being grouped together so that the local people and local councillors will not be able to decide how the money from their developments that have happened in their area is spent. So it might have been spent on a parks improvement or a zebra crossing or something in the past. I'm afraid that's all going.
Okay, so what about the crossings, the lollipop ladies, the lollipop men around the city? That's surely one of the most horrible things to be taking away. I mean, why is that happening? How is it happening? What's the extent of it?
Well, there's a whole list of comparatively small expenditure items, which if there was more careful thought, I mean, you know, we've had £300,000 paid out to ex-chief executives. We've had millions of pounds sent back to government because the administration can't get their act together and can't work out how to spend the money. We've had all sorts of wastage from this administration. And yet all it is doing is bleating about, we haven't got any choice, it's all the evil government. Well, you know, I don't approve of the way government are actually running things either, and they're far too hard on local government. But that doesn't mean to say that you haven't got a responsibility, if you're the local administration, to do the very best you can and get the best out of what money is available. And I'm afraid a lot better could be done if there wasn't an awful lot of preening and visits to America and China, and there was a bit more concentration again on the basics, right?
Well, hang on. I think that's just a bit of jealousy. You haven't been on an international trip, maybe, recently. I mean, surely it's a good idea to be... If we can drag in some investment from Beijing, surely that's a great thing.
Well, I think that some of the conditions on it, as we found out from Hinckley, could be a little questionable, a little dubious. And, I mean, I think people in Bristol... if there were any investment coming in from that angle, which would be a little surprising, but if it were, I would want to see the small print in a lot of detail, just as I wanted to see the small print with regard to the wholly owned subsidiaries of the council, where reports came in a few days ago, but I'm afraid because I was away for a couple of days, wasn't allowed to read the reports, but I can guarantee they wouldn't make pretty reading. The energy company, the waste company, and the management structure of these organisations. I think if the public could see what was actually happening, they'd be horrified.
Well, we're here today. Bristol's tallest building has just got planning permission despite objections over affordable housing. The new tallest building in Bristol, this is in the Bristol Post, will include 375 homes over two buildings and a 24-storey tower. Planning permission for the tallest building was granted despite concerns over those number of affordable homes. The new development will be built on the former Bristol Ambulance Station site opposite Castle Park. Well, it's going to kind of dominate the city, really, isn't it? And it will include those 375 homes over the two buildings, reaching almost 100 metres. The tower will be taller than St Mary Redcliffe, 89 metre church spire, 80 metre Castlemead building, and the 68 metre Wills Memorial building. But the development might not hold the mantle of tallest building for long, as Bristol University has planned to build a 25 storey tower as part of its new campus at Temple Quarter. The council approved plans for the former ambulance station at a meeting on Wednesday. Again, I'm guessing that the council owned that ambulance station land and they've actually made a fortune on if they can get this whole thing built and paid for.
Well, they did own it. I don't know what deal has actually been done on that. Wasn't involved in any stage of that, but there is potentially a lot of cash.
also, one does wonder whether this has just been done for the money, because the Bristol ambulances have now been stuck, actually not far from us here at Eastern Community Centre, near the Barton Hill roundabout, not far from there, on a kind of little side road on an industrial estate. Doesn't seem like necessarily the best place for the central Bristol ambulance station. It almost looks as if someone said, oh, well, here's some money we can make from selling off the ambulance station, but hasn't really thought about where the new one should be.
Well, I think that the ambulance service is quite challenged for all sorts of reasons at the moment.
You know, if it was me, what I'd do is I'd build a new ambulance station in a right place, and then I would say, OK, well, we'll now move the people out of the previous one. Not say, oh, you can hang out in an industrial estate for a while.
Yeah, I mean, you can't, with the response times that are required, put all the ambulances in one place to cover Bristol. It doesn't work if you want to get the ambulances to people quickly enough. Bristol traffic is not the easiest to navigate through, even with the Blue and Two going. And bluntly, they need to have outlier stations anyway.
Martin, what do you think that the priorities for public services like ambulances are just simply following a national pattern, really?
Well, I think you've got to remember that the ambulance service isn't run by the local council, so the decision whether they're going to rent it, a part of their land to an ambulance station or not, is a commercial decision. These things should be, of course, joined up. And they're not. I mean, for example, I don't think that local authorities should be responsible for social care. That should be an NHS responsibility. And therefore, you know, they can unblock their own beds by making sure that there's things for people to get, you know, services for people to go to. And the idea of having the local authorities deal with the social care and the NHS deal with the patients, that clearly isn't working, in my view. And you know, you're getting all the problems that you get with the postcode lotteries and all the rest
of it. Well, Bristol hit the national news for all the wrong reasons this week with the death of and the investigation into chap Bijan Ibrahimi. Bristol City Council and Avon and Somerset Police were condemned as institutionally racist in the case of Bijan Ibrahimi. So maybe you could tell us what you make of that. It doesn't sound good, Gary, does it, if both the City Council and the police are institutionally racist?
It certainly isn't good, and I must say I was very concerned when I saw some of the people from the police who were involved in this and their reaction to the cries for help from Mr. Ibrahimi, and some of them were not, came out of it comparatively unscathed, which I've got to say surprised me.
Martin Summers?
Well, I think
it's not good, is it, when Bristol hits the national news in this way at all?
No, it's not. And, you know, there's obviously been considerable concern about the response of both the police and of the council. And I believe both the council and the police have taken on board that they got it wrong and they're going to try and do better next time. It's not going to bring anybody back, though, is it?
Is there any... do you think there should be prosecutions of council employees and police in situations
this? That's a matter for the police, if you like.
Well, I mean, are you asking the police to prosecute themselves?
Well, a police officer has been sent to prison over this.
Yeah.
So they have. He's not very happy about that. He thinks that he's not to blame. And of course, the guy who actually carried out the murder, he was sent down as well. The whole thing's a very sad set of affairs. But the fact is that certain people have been sent to prison, including a police officer.
Are we in a better position now, do you think? Because one wonders whether these are just a sort of an announcement. I mean, I can remember when the whole business of the National Inquiry into Child Sex Abuse, VIP Defile Inquiry, started with the look at Jimmy Savile. And all the ramifications of that, there was a sort of big announcement. They said, oh, well, this could never happen again. Are you confident of that?
No. I think, unfortunately, lots of institutions that police themselves, and police, not just the police, but all the large institutions that police themselves, they have a remarkable ability to protect their own.
We're going to go to Prime Minister's questions from Wednesday earlier on this week now. And it was Jeremy Corbyn speaking about, in fact, various things. But we're going to have a listen now to a question about the National Health Service. Is it going to really survive the Christmas?
A&E waiting time targets haven't been met for 2.5 years. Cancer treatment targets haven't been met for 2 years. Our A&E departments are bursting at the seams because the government has failed to ensure that people can get a GP appointment when they need one. The government promised to recruit an extra 5,000 GPs by 2020. Where are they?
Prime Minister!
Seeing more GPs. We are seeing more training places for our GPs, but if he wants to talk about targets, if he wants to talk about what we see on targets, he talks about A&E. Well, let's look at what has happened in Wales. On the standard on A&E in Wales was last met in 2008. Just think, which party's in government in Wales? Is it the Conservatives? No, it's the Labour Party in government in Wales. On cancer care, the standard was last met in June 2008 in Wales. He should look at what the Labour Party are actually delivering before he comes to this House and complains.
I don't know the detail of what's been going on here, what the different figures are, but the fact is that senior managers in the NHS have all said that there is a crisis. I'm aware of these people speaking out quite recently and the fuss that's been caused. The fact is that the austerity policies pursued by the government mean that there are insufficient resources for all sorts of things, including the NHS, including in Wales.
The resources are surely out there, aren't they?
Yes, they're all in the Cayman Islands, because that's the way we run things in this country, where we bail banks out, and then the people who work in those banks and the shareholders of those banks then take the money out of the country to these places, and they don't pay any taxes on it. The money's all there, but it's all in private hands as a result of the bailout of 2008.
From one leader of the opposition in Westminster to another leader of the opposition here in Bristol, what do you make of this thing of GP appointments, Gary? Because although I know it's not something that the council's directly responsible for, of course it affects people in your ward. It affects millions of people across the country.
Yes, it does. And the council cannot employ GPs. But what they can do is to make certain that where there's new developments, that the right buildings and facilities are there to make it easier for those, you know, the doctors' practices to flourish. And Whitchurch and Hengrove, where there's proposals, stupid proposals, for massive amount of house building, completely breaking the pledge about the park that was actually going to be there, there's already massive problems with people accessing a GP. And thousands of houses to be built without any thought of putting in a GP practice. No facilities. I mean, that's where the council is adding to the problem.
Well, surely the council is, you know, unless someone actually comes along and says we want to build a GP practice, there's not a lot the council can do, is there?
Well, absolutely there is. It's what's called structured development, thinking about what facilities will be needed in a community before you just throw up hundreds of houses and bank the cash.
I think
Sadley Brook was an example of what went wrong, and that's some years ago.
And also another thing to think of over the holidays, I just also suggest if you've got any elderly relative, make sure you go and check on them at least sometime over Christmas and the New Year, because what with the cuts to benefits, changes to benefits, a lot of more poor people around, possibly even people helping themselves to other people's benefits, wouldn't be the first time that I'd seen that happening. Do go and check on your loved ones and check that they're financially and physically and mentally okay over the holidays. But here's a question that came up on Wednesday at Prime Minister's questions about the terminally ill.
Building a Britain fit for the future.
Drew Hendry! Yeah.
For many terminally ill people on universal credit, this Christmas will be their last Christmas. Does the Prime Minister agree with me that it can never be appropriate for terminally ill people to be forced to meet with work coaches or to fit into an arbitrary 6 months prognosis in order to claim support? So will she listen finally to the experts at MND UK and Macmillan Cab and remove these conditions to allow some dignity as these people with their families face the end of their lives?
The Honourable Gentleman is right that we have to ensure that we are dealing with those cases where somebody does have a terminal illness with utmost sensitivity. These are issues that have been raised before. The conditions, the principles that are applying to terminally ill people claiming universal credit are in fact the same as for those claiming employment and support allowance, and they've remained the same for successive governments. There are a number of approaches that can be taken, and there are several options for how people progress through the system. But he's right, we should deal with people who are terminally ill with sensitivity. That's what the system is, that's what the system intends to do.
Well, universal credit, the theory of it, was fine. The problem is that if you chop great chunks of cash out of it as it's being rolled out, you're going to have problems. And if they effectively deal with one set of problems and find the cash in that within a limited budget, other problems are going to pop up elsewhere. And bluntly, you need to have a somewhat different approach from the ministers in charge.
Martin?
Well, universal credit, the principle of paying one payment to everybody could in principle be good as long as there was no conditions.
What we're talking about here is these checks on terminally ill people.
Yes, I know. Well, I mean, I remember seeing a couple of years ago now, I was in a pub at lunchtime, this lad came in and he was looking for the gaffer because he wanted to get some work, and he said the gaffer wasn't there, and he said, I've actually got spine cancer. I've just had an operation on my spine. I've got another one in 6 weeks' time, but I've been told I've got to go out and find part-time work. Now, this whole attitude that people who are ill must be available for work, that's just a mental attitude. It's a punishing attitude coming down from the top, and many people in comfortable circumstances in this country do not realise how absolutely wrong this is. And lots of people have been refused universal credit or disability payments, and then subsequently died. And in fact, the government is keeping a lid on the figures on that because they know it's going to be very embarrassing if that comes out.
Why are they doing that?
Because they know very well that lots of people have died who've been they've been denied EPA or whatever on the grounds that they're fit for work, and then they die. And they've got figures on this, but they won't bring them out.
Well, fascinating, appalling. Come on, get yourself together, central government. Also, there's on a sort of related thing, it's to do with poverty, is that a lot of people are dying from drug overdoses and dirty needles, that sort of thing. And at Prime Minister's Questions Again this week, there was a suggestion about what we should be doing about that, what many other countries are doing, and why aren't we?
Ronnie Cowan.
Here.
Thank you very much. Prime Minister, in 8 European countries plus Australia and Canada, they've introduced drug consumption rooms. The result has been a reduction in the spread of HIV, reduction in the spread of hepatitis C, reduction in crime. And it's worth noting that while drug-related deaths in the last 4 years continue to increase in the UK, there's never been a drug overdose in a supervised drug consumption room. In the interest of public health, will the Prime Minister introduce DCRs in the United Kingdom? Or if not, we should devolve the relevant powers to the Scottish Parliament so the Scottish Government can go on and do so.
Yeah.
Prime Minister!
Gentlemen, first of all, as I'm sure he will be aware, the Home Office has recently published the Government's updated drug strategy. But I have to say to him that I have a different opinion from some members of this House. There are some members of this House who are very liberal in their approach to the way that drugs should be treated. I'm very clear that we should recognise the damage that drugs do to people's lives. Our aim should be to ensure that people come off drugs, don't go on drugs in the first place, and then people keep clear from drugs. That's what we should focus on.
I agree that drugs are dangerous, but in actual fact, the enforcement policies over recent years have just not worked effectively. And there needs to be a recognition of why people actually take drugs, and a more effective way of getting them away from the drugs rather than failed enforcement.
I mean, surely one of the basic reasons has got to be, if you're having a very bad time in life, you've got nowhere to live, you've got no money, etc., the drugs at least help you forget.
I think that's a factor.
We're talking about alcohol as well, of course.
Yeah, of course. It's certainly a factor. There are also physical attributes that some people have which make them more prone to addiction. And there's a whole list of factors which really are not properly taken into account by the so-called enforcement strategy, which actually it just makes life extremely difficult for the police and doesn't solve the problem. you need not just the drug consumption rooms. You need to think, right, heroin is dangerous, but has the way that we try to tackle that worked, or do we need to work on a completely different method of actually dealing with the dealers and actually helping the people who are the customers?
Before we hear from Martin, there was a excellent piece on Channel 4 News on Tuesday this week. The headline was, her name was Lindy, the story of a homeless woman who died on the streets. And it's part of Channel 4 News' Out in the Cold season. 3 weeks ago, a woman was found dead in a park at the heart of Cardiff. She'd been sleeping rough in a tent. And in the headlines that were in the Cardiff papers, they didn't even know her name. Well, Channel 4 News' Home Affairs correspondent Andy Davis and some of his helpers went down to Cardiff and actually managed to track down who this person was and the circumstances around her. Even found her sister as well, who'd been to see her before she died. And obviously it was a very emotional thing to see her sister there begging on the streets. 3 weeks ago, a 32-year-old woman was found dead in a park in the heart of Cardiff. She'd been sleeping rough in a tent. This is Lindy Louise Pring's story, told with the help of those who loved her. Martin, this is just one person in a way. It's a kind of statistic, but what Channel 4 News here have done is shown the whole backstory to this person, who she was and why she ended up on the streets.
Well, did she die of a drugs overdose? Well, in that case, it's a homelessness story rather than a drug story, isn't it? Well, I mean, on coming back to the drugs story...
I think she may have been a drug user, but she died. Apparently, she died of cold.
Yeah, just basic stuff. Well, the homelessness is massively increasing in this country. It's massively increased since the Tories won the election. And it's to do with universal credit. One of the things about universal credit is that anybody on universal credit, private landlords won't rent to them, which is why they find it so difficult.
Isn't there an element of survival of the fittest here? Lindy wasn't the fittest, was she?
No, but I think what's actually happening is in the past, people basically were looked after, and the policy that's been pursued since universal credit has been brought in, it's been a mechanism for this, is that we're not actually going to help people through crises. For example, not paying people's rent and so on leads them living on the streets. And there's a massive increase in people living on the streets. That's just not just anecdotal, it's factual. And of course, these people, A, don't vote. If they did vote, they'd be voting in probably solid non-Tory constituencies. And even if they voted, it wouldn't make any difference with the electoral systems messed up. Meanwhile, we're spending loads of money on Help to Buy for potential young Tory voters to be subsidised into their into the home of their dreams at taxpayer expense.
We had people living homeless in St Matthias Park moved on earlier this week, and up in Stoke-on-Trent, they've kind of wonderful, novel way of dealing with people living in tents. Homeless people could be fined £1,000, Gary, for putting up a tent under new plans which have angered charity bosses up in Stoke-on-Trent Tory-controlled council.
Well, I mean, good luck in terms of collecting the fine, because I think they're going to have some difficulty doing that, aren't they?
Well, that will. What it's actually doing is it's criminalising people like that, isn't it? Because they won't be able to pay the fine; they'll have to go to jail.
Fine, and quite frankly, if you any law that you pass, you've got to think, how could this be enforced? What will the effect of it actually be? And I don't think they thought that one through very well.
Well, maybe they did. Maybe they just thought, well, at least these people will be criminalised, put into the prison, and we won't have to cope with them trying to claim houses from the local council. They're out of the way, effectively.
In the meantime, a lot of money has been spent by the council fruitlessly chasing around rather than actually getting on and helping to solve the problem.
Is the same sort of thing happening here in Bristol? Because I know for a while there was a policy of actually taking people's tents. That I think was last year, is it?
It's still happening, yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of people are very concerned about it.
Surely that's theft, isn't it? If you've got a tent and it's the only place you've got to live, or any of your property, if someone comes along and takes it away?
Well, you do legally need to have permission to pitch a tent somewhere, so... You know, it's slightly more complicated than it being theft. But quite frankly, the local authority has a duty to try and help, not to actually cause more problems.
But surely, you know, this is a way of at least making sure that if people are going to live in a tent, it's not right in your face in a park or something.
Well, yes, people want to use their parks. I think that, those people who are concerned about their little local park. I understand that. But instead of actually just saying, right, we're going to fine these people £1,000 and you're not going to get the money, it would be far better to think of a constructive way where the tents might be pitched somewhere else.
Martin, Tory's shocking record on homelessness revealed in the Mirror this week, part of their homelessness blog, which I mentioned last week. It's actually really good. I put another link up to it on our show page this week. It's on the Mirror. 121,360 children are living in temporary accommodation. A report by the local government and social care ombudsman reveals families in the UK are routinely being housed in damp, or infested temporary accommodation now in the UK for weeks on end. And the total, they reckon, for this Christmas is over 120,000 kids across the UK.
And it's increasing. It's not as if there's always been a problem with this, but it's actually getting worse as a result of things like universal credit.
Well, it's also apparently it's soaring private rental costs, wage freezes and benefit cuts all together is causing this total crisis. The children are among 79,000, 190,000, that's nearly 80,000 households living a fragile existence in dingy rooms and B&Bs on temporary accommodation, a 65% rise over since 2010.
Well, that's right. And this is criminal. A lot of it is partly to do with
well,
austerity.
It's not criminal, is it?
Well, I say criminal, I'm using a political rhetoric there. The fact is that a lot of this is due to austerity, and a lot of it is just due to administrative administrative sadism, basically. I mean, they could easily change the universal credit rules so that landlords were paid directly as they used to be under the old system. But they haven't, and that's why they've not been
able to... Well, are you saying they're doing this deliberately?
They're doing it deliberately because Ian Duncan Smith said that you have to wait 6 weeks, now 5 weeks, to get your first money so that you can start thinking like a middle class salary earner. And but then when you get your money, of course, you've already been
to Wonga.
Well, he's
got to do something to address Worksheim family.
No, yes, well, exactly. This is the whole point. The whole point of this has been geared around the idea that we've somehow got to change the behaviour of people who are claimants. Whereas the previous system was based on the idea we're going to try and keep them in their houses and therefore not make them homeless. Including the children, of course, who've got no responsibility for what their parents do or don't do. And, of course, they've not done that. They've got this whole... And they won't let go of the idea. Everybody is telling them, well, why don't we just go back to the old system of paying landlords directly? And they don't want to do that because that would mean that Ian Duncan Smith was an idiot. So they can't do that, so they're not going to do it because the Tory party balance of power is such that they can't offend him. But the fact of the matter is that they should, and eventually they will, because otherwise a universal credit is going to crash and burn.
That's a lot of kids, 120,000, Gary.
Well, actually, there's a big problem in Bristol over this, in that the budget for temporary accommodation has gone up through the spending on it has gone up through the roof, and it's not productive spending either. Unfortunately, the City Council has over the last few years not got the temporary accommodation available to house the people that they've got a legal responsibility to deal with, and that means they're paying out fortunes to private landlords who are making a lot of money out of this, out of people's homelessness. And the City Council have been slow in terms of getting to grips with the problem, and they should, in actual fact, have some property available for the people who need to be temporarily housed, instead of paying out fortunes to private landlords who are renting on a weekly basis and making a lot of money.
Well, I'll do my very best in 2018 to get the Mayor, Marvin Rees, Labour Party Mayor, on this programme talking about these things. But it's very difficult actually to get in touch with the Mayor's office. But now when you phone them, you get this on the answer phone, which is a new message. You used to be able to actually speak to them. Now you get this.
Hello, Bristol City Council has tried to reach you, but unfortunately this number will not connect you back to that team or person. Please accept our apologies for this inconvenience. If required, someone will get back in touch. Thank you for calling.
Well, they hadn't tried to reach me. I tried to reach them. What do you make of that message, Gary?
Well, I'm afraid it's all part of the corporate speak that comes out of the administration at the moment. And, I mean, we're going to see even more of it. We've actually got a position now where the mayor is trying to ban effective questioning from councillors in another change in the constitution of the council.
This is is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.